It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 652 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I'm talking with Deb Aoki and Christopher Woodrow Butcher about Search and Destroy, which is presented by Fantagraphics in partnership with MSX Mangusplaining Extra. Search and Destroy is described this way. It's a brilliantly crafted action thriller about an outsider looking for meaning and vengeance in the unjust world that took everything away from her. We discuss how this project came to be, delve into manga itself, and explore who the characters are, as well as what else we can expect from them in the future. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they both have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Search and Destroy is a brilliantly crafted action thriller about an outsider looking for meaning and vengeance in the unjust world that took everything away from her. It's called Search and Destroy, and it's a tale of rage, rage against hypocrisy, injustice, exploitation, and the wrongs done to a child who grew into a righteous killer. And talking with me about that is, the first one is editor Christopher Woodrow Butcher. How you doing, Chris?
Hey, good, thanks. How you doing?
Good. It's good to talk with you. And then we've got Deb Aoki, I think, is involved also with this whole operation. Good things. How you doing, Deb?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thanks for having us.
All right. Christopher, let's start with you and talk about you guys are involved in what's called MSX Mangusplaining Extra.
Yeah, that's us. Deb and I, my husband Andrew, and a couple other folks are basically started our own independent manga publishing company a couple years ago, thanks to a generous investment. And we serialize translated manga online through our newsletter at Substack. And Search and Destroy is our second print project that's come out of that. We've serialized, I think, 5 volumes worth of material now, and a bunch of short stories and things like that. Search and Destroy is our second print project. We've got a third one coming up in a few months, and we're working with a number of different publishers once we do the digital edition to put it into print.
So you guys have a podcast of your own, right?
We do, actually, yeah. Deb is one of the manga experts. Deb, myself, and David Brothers are manga experts on Mangusplaining, where we explain manga to our friend, the comic book writer, Chip Zdarsky.
Oh, really?
You might know Chip. Yeah, you might know Chip from, Batman and Daredevil mm-hmm. and Public Domain. And he just started a free monthly comics newsletter that he's sending to comic shops, which I think is hilarious.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
See, I'm a Batman guy, and I've been trying to get a chance to interview him because I've interviewed like Scott Snyder and whole bunches of other Batman people, but he's one that I have real trouble getting a hold of. So I'll figure out some way to make that happen.
Yeah, for sure. He's a busy guy. We barely get him to sit down to do an episode of the podcast with us.
Yeah, we're really grateful that he makes the time for us on the podcast, because he's tightly scheduled, that dude.
Now I have to ask, of course, Mangusplaining, I think, is a play on mansplaining, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and it was Chip's idea. he's a very clever guy.
Uh-huh. Very
cool.
It's
a perfect name for what we're doing, because we are basically explaining manga to Chip, and our tagline is, for people who haven't read much manga before.
Yeah.
I was talking with Christopher a little before we started the interview, and I have to say that I'm an American comics guy. And I was mentioning to you, the both of you, before we started to record, the fact that in the 80s, I was reading some manga for a while, and it was My the Psychic Girl, and it was Eagle was another one that was going out at that time. And a lot of people who are into manga today have never heard of those books, which made me laugh.
Even before they were born, to be perfectly honest. Yeah.
True that. I have to say.
And they're very out of print, so...
Oh, yeah. That's too bad, because I really liked that. Because Sci-Fi Channel also used to have on Sunday morning an anime festival every Saturday morning, and I used to tape them. Wow. There was one that was about Superman's daughter, is what it was. And I was fascinated by it because it was interesting to see the superpowers in a whole different perspective like that. So and I was telling you also, I've been buying some of the DC ones because I'm a Batman guy. And that Joker, One Operation Joker, I liked. And I'm training my brain to think in manga terminology. So why don't, if you guys would like to explain a little bit of the history of manga and maybe kind of take some of us Americans up to speed who may not be as familiar as you guys are.
You want to take that one on, Chris?
I mean, let's tag team it. I can say that we actually are starting our fifth season of Mangasplaining in a week or two with a book called Manga Manga, The History of Japanese Comics. And it was written originally in 83 and then adapted. When was it updated, Deb? Was it like 86 or 92?
It was updated in like 1989 or something like that. But
and so it covers basically, you know, everything up to then in manga. And so that's going to be a good episode, actually. If you're just like, I don't know where to start with manga, that's a great book. It's by Frederick Schott. And but the short answer is Japan has a visual sort of narrative history that goes into its art going back quite a long time. And with the advent of comic books brought over by GIs following World War II during the rebuilding period, a lot of newspaper cartoons and like funny single illustrations for kids sort of morphed more into American style comics. A lot of people don't know that there's like been a lot of cultural exchange between manga and American comics, you know, over many, many centuries over many, many decades. Whoops. And I think the manga that we have today sort of comes out of that post-war boom in manga. So the big names there are people like Shotaro Ishinomori, who basically recreated the concept that would become Power Rangers, or Osamu Tezuka, who created a lot of the books that, Astro Boy is probably the most famous, but one of his more well-regarded books is Dororo, which is what our book, Search and Destroy, adapts. Dororo was set in Deb, you're the expert on Dororo. Do you want to give an example of what it's all about?
Well, Dororo was originally written and serialized in the late 60s, and the story concept is that you meet this young man, and he's basically not what he seems. This is set in like feudal era Japan, but and he's like a wanderer of sorts, but he surprisingly, when he has a lot of prosthetic parts, like his eyes aren't his eyes, and his legs are basically false legs, and like his arms, you know, he can pull off one of his arms and it's a sword. And there's a reason for that. It's because his father basically sold all his body parts to a bunch of demons, one by one, you know, kind of like, not like he sold all of them at one place. He gave someone the eyes and someone, you know, their legs and so on. And so Hyakumaru is basically on this mission to find all the demons that have all his various parts of his body and reclaim his humanity. And it's a pretty intense, and even in the 1968 version, 69 version, it's pretty violent and it's kind of wild. So Kodansha has published this in English. So if you can read the story in English, and there's two anime adaptations if you want to check it out. But it's a when you really think about it, it's like, that's a story he wrote in 1969, and it is wildly inventive. It's unlike any fantastic other samurai-type story you've ever seen.
Well, I have to say, one of the things that they do, I had a chance to read the first volume. And
of Search and Destroy?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
They made it available to me so I could take a look at it, so I have some idea what I'm talking about when I'm asking questions and stuff. I do have to say, the stuff with the eyes is a little off-putting on some levels. You have to be in the right mood to come across those sections. I luckily I was reading this late at night, and I was like, oh wow, oh okay, oh, that's interesting, because you know there's all, you know, it's I mean, did the original book contain all this stuff of all these things? Because if it's in feudal Japan, I can, this book is updated into what they're saying is a dystopian post Cold War future.
Yeah.
So I can get that, but were those elements in the original book?
I think that there's definitely a lot of the creator, Atsushi Kaneko's unique flavor in this adaptation. He's done a lot of work that has themes of body horror, themes of, you know, cyberpunk sort of stuff, and also straight up horror and sort of, you know, David Lynch-y kind of, you know, kind of material. It's funny, you were like, the eye is the thing that got me, because we were talking to somebody else and they were like, oh my God, the bit with the tongue, I was so disgusted. So, you know, there's lots of body parts I should say in this version, Hyaku's body parts have, this is kind of spoilers for the end of Volume 1, but just like in Dororo, Hyaku's body parts have been taken when they were very young and been replaced with cybernetics. So more of that sort of Blade Runner-y, cyberpunk kind of a thing. And in this version, she is a woman, or a young woman instead of a man. And so she's on a very... you know, if you liked Kill Bill, she's on a revenge quest to get back what is hers in this one. And yeah, lots of body parts for her to pick up. You can be very grossed out every chapter or two. It'll be great. And if body horror and cyberpunk and transhumanism are not themes that you want in your work, this might not be the book for you. But trust us, it's a lot of fun.
Well, I, what got me was several years back, I had cataract surgery. And let me tell you, that was the most painful thing that I went through. It was just awful stuff. So anything to do with the eyes, I recoil in horror.
Oh, you feel it viscerally, don't you? My goodness.
Oh, I can't tell you. My eyes started to hurt when I was looking at that.
Wow. I never thought of it that way, because I didn't have the same reaction as you. I had a reaction to the tongue part.
Yeah.
But that was why that got to me. I knew, but oh.
Wow.
See, one thing we should mention too is this book is black and white. I think a lot of manga is black and white.
Yeah, I would say most of it.
Yeah, American comics tend to be color, full color, although we go through periods like Turtles and stuff like that where they're black and white. But I think sometimes black and white is better because it's starker and it leaves your imagination filling in some of the gaps more. And so, I was convinced there, if this had been color, we'd see a lot of red.
So ideally, I think it's great when artists have the freedom to choose how they want to tell their stories, like whether or not they want to add a little bit of color or a little bit or use screen tones to give like a textured gray effect or what have you. And as more and more artists, especially in Japan, I mean, this was traditionally published in like a magazine and then collected into books, just like most manga is in Japan, sort of like the single issue floppies to trade paperback system in North America. But a lot of artists in Japan now are serializing their work online and, you know, putting it on Twitter or web image hosting sites like Pixiv, which is really popular in Japan, sort of like Japanese DeviantArt, I guess, is the way to go, but much more professional. Yeah, I think artists can decide if they want to do color, and you're starting to see a lot of books, a lot of stories that are more hybrids, that'll be little splashes of color here and there, but mostly black and white. And I think that's kind of cool.
Will the book have like instructions on how American readers should approach it? Because I noticed in the DC ones, they had like an instruction thing at the beginning that said, this is how you read this book. You turn it this way and go this way to this way. Is that going to be in there? Are people basically going to be, you're going to expect they understand manga already?
You know, that used to be a really common thing that you would find in almost every manga. It would, you know, be the back page. It says, you're reading it the wrong way. But, I'm picking up my copy of Search and Destroy, and it doesn't have that.
Yeah, we didn't do that in that one. And we didn't do it in our first book, Okinawa, which was also published in the Japanese orientation. And I don't think it's not in Gigatown, and it probably won't be in any of the upcoming books either. It's just, you know, the kind of work we're doing, I think if something was really for new readers or older readers who hadn't encountered a lot of manga before, I think we would consider sort of doing more instructional stuff or whatnot. But we do find that when you hand people a book that's backwards, they go, oh, actually, we just did the American Library Association, Deb and I, and we would get these librarians who were like, you know, super awesome and down with everything and whatever. And then every once in a while we'd hand them, it's like, oh, this is the book we're doing. And they'd be like, oh, I remember when I had to learn how to read these backwards books. And it was just like, so I think, yeah, I don't know. Deb, what's your take on that? I don't think we've ever talked about it, about people, especially like people our age, like we're not, you know, the young folks picking up manga for the first time.
I have run into that where some people genuinely tell me like they're genuinely confused by it and they find it difficult. Mm. Less often than I used to. But I also find that, you know, I sometimes run into that too, because sometimes when I'm, you know, because right now, I mean, I grew up reading American comics too. I have a pretty good working knowledge of the characters of most of the superhero series up to 1995.
Okay.
But let me see. But it's just kind of like sometimes when I go back to reading American comics, like, or worse yet, French comics, Bande Dessinée, I find it so dense and difficult to read. Like, it's so wordy. And it's like, a lot of times it's, you know, people talking and not doing, so it's hard for me to get into.
Manga's kind of the opposite.
Yeah, manga's very visual, you know, so, you know, I think, I don't know, I mean, I can read both, but it's I do find myself sometimes like, oh, you know what the best example is? Okay, so now there's a lot of Korean comics coming out in print. They're originally webtoons, and they read Western style. Because Korean language is written horizontally, left to right. And so, whereas Japanese text natively, it reads up and down. So because of that,
right to left, right?
And right to left. So that's why the pages are that way, right? Because natively, the way you read Japanese is from right to left. You know, up and down, right to left. So, yeah, it's interesting because sometimes I'll pick up a Korean comic and I'll go like, whoa, wait, what? And then, you know, then I'll just dive right into it. Because in it, Korean comics too, like manga is very visual, but it does take me a little bit. You know, like it's that moment of opening it up on the wrong side.
Well, I think you said something that interests me because, you know, I've grown up reading American comics and occasionally dabbling into manga and stuff like that. But you're right in that a lot of American comics, I think writers feel that they have to show that they're actually doing something profound and good. So they put up boatloads of words on the page. Sometimes I turn a page and I look and there's the word, this massive word balloon up to the top of the page. And I'm like, you know what? They'll tell me what that was all about later. And I just turn the page. But do you think, because manga right now is like I was saying before we started recording that New York Comic Con last year had smaller American comic sections and bigger manga sections, which is interesting to me because, you know, and there's a lot of people saying that manga is kind of shoving out American comics and things like that.
I wouldn't say it was shoving out. It was that American comics withdrew from that particular show. Like Marvel and a lot of the American publishers, and DC, for example, that's just like opted not to have booths. And, you know, nature and manga abhors a vacuum, so they sold those spots. And now when I walk into New York Comic Con, it is wall to wall One Piece and Dragon Ball and Yu-Gi-Oh! And it's like, whoa. But do you think it's really noticeable. It was crazy.
You mentioned something then that caught my attention about the fact that there's a lot more action and activity going on in manga than, say, American comics. Do you think that's one of the reasons why manga is as popular as it is these days?
Well, for one thing I want to mention is that a lot of manga is written and drawn by the same person. You know, versus being split up into writer and inker and penciler and stuff like that, the way it is in a lot of American comics. So the person who is drawing it is also thinking not just about writing dialogue and describing what's happening, but actually how it's going to look and how it's going to be presented to readers.
There are some American writers who are really good at that, I think.
Right.
And Chip, we're lucky to work with Chip because he's definitely one of them.
Chip is an artist too, that's why. So
he thinks really visually. He tailors his scripts to the kind of script he writes for White Trees is going to be different than the kind of script that he writes for Daredevil, for example, or the kind of script he writes on Public Domain for his own work. And we talk a lot about that. And it's on the podcast and, you know, just hanging out. And it is so wild to think about the idea that, you know, a writer will send in a script and just never get a chance to even talk to the person who's drawing it. To like offer feedback or criticism or you know, kudos. You're like, hey, way to go. That's exactly what I was trying to achieve with what I wrote. And that just doesn't happen in manga. Like, it just absolutely does not happen. And I think that that's one of the probably the big differences is that you're getting something that's closer. You know, even with, you know, manga creators, mangaka have assistants that help them with like little details like, you know, drawing background figures or screen tones or whatever. But I think that is one of the big differences is that there's a harmony. Oh, is that shitty? There's a there's a deliberateness that comes from the creator, I think, that you see in manga. And it's something that can really connect with people. And I think we see it in American comics, like when a creative team is really like firing on all cylinders, working together, you know, like and working together, everything from Claremont and Byrne to Capullo and Snyder on Batman, you know, those are and we look at those runs and go, man, those are the best runs, you know, Watchmen, it was Dave Gibbons and Alan Moore, and they're working together super closely. And it's so great. And it's like, well, why do you think that is? And why do you think, you know, a random comic you read last week where the artist and the writer have never talked to each other in person didn't do quite as well or isn't quite as successful. So I got opinions on American comics. Don't get me wrong, but I do think that that's one of the things that manga does pretty well.
So the manga editors work really closely with the artists and writers. Like,
absolutely.
You know, like they will, the way that it works is like, they'll bring storyboards to the editor, and the editor sometimes will, you know, take a pen and go like, hey, how about you move this panel this way? And how about if you make it flow this way? I've seen examples of Death Note, which is an example of a writer and an artist, two different people. The writer will do storyboards and say, here's how I envision this. And then the artist will do their own version of the story, like, how about like this? But, you know, they go back and forth. It's not like and of course, I'm sure there must be like this in Japan in some way, but it's not like, you know, the artist gets a stack of paper with, you know, stack of a document with just script. Right. And said, make it so. It's like it comes as storyboards.
I've got to ask about Search and Destroy a couple of questions. You mentioned that the main character was male in the original book and now is female. Did you guys make that change? Did the creator decide to go that way? And if so, why? Why make that change?
So, well, the story was completely created by the time we decided to license. We had no input in this. But
yeah. The thing that people maybe don't understand about manga is that it's already done in Japan. In like the Japanese author, writer, artist, you know, Atsushi Kaneko wrote a 3-volume story, and now we license the rights to translate it into English. So our job as the production people is to just make it as authentic as possible, as close to the original in Japanese as we can for the North American audience. So yeah, that's manga. We didn't change the characters. We didn't change the character's gender.
But was there a reason, though? Because my understanding is originally was male and then became female. Was that the creator decided to change that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting, because there's a book in America called Trekker, and it's about a female bounty hunter. And when I was talking to Ron Randall, who actually made the book, and he does outstanding Kickstarter stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah. I've met him. He does. He's really good at Kickstarter.
Yeah. Oh, he's excellent. He's one of the best. But I had to ask him. I said, how different would the book have been if you decided to go with a male lead instead of a female lead? And he had to think about it for a couple of minutes. But he was like, I don't know. I don't know if it'd been nearly as good. You know, it would have been as interesting. His perspective. So I'm always interested when this kind of thing happens. Why was that done? Was that done, you know, to reach audiences today because we're used to more female lead characters than we were back in the 60s?
So I think there's something there, if I had to guess. I've gotten a chance to talk to the creator. This is something else that doesn't usually happen, is you don't get to actually talk to the creator of the manga that you're working on. And we've gotten a chance to talk to Kaneko-sensei a little bit. There's probably a lot of thematic resonance in making a character whose bodily autonomy has been compromised a woman rather than a dude. I think that there are a lot of discussions, rightly so, that are happening in America, but also in Japan and Canada and around the world, about the bodily autonomy of women, about women getting to make their own choices about their own bodies. And this is someone who, at their core, had everything, almost everything, stripped away from them. And making that character a woman really makes it powerful. And you start to see it, especially in sort of upcoming volumes. But even in the first volume, like right away, you're not used to a young woman who's like this angry about things. And then you really think about what she's been through and you're like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Actually, she should be livid. She should be furious. And I think that rage is really what drives a lot of the book.
It's really fascinating read. I have to say, I was like, now that does lead me to another question. Sometimes when people put manga, make it for American audiences, they pull the panels apart and put them in the sequence that Americans are used to. Mm-hmm. But your book doesn't do that. Your book it follows the right to left thing of
too
manga.
Much work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
So it is a lot of work. And there used to be, in the early days of the manga, and the manga that you mentioned, right? Like My Psychic Girl and
right.
Eagle and so on. I mean, some of these manga at the time, to make it more palatable and more accessible to Western readers who weren't used to manga, they did just that. They would flip some panels. They would lay them out. Like if you look at Blade of the Immortal by Hiroki Samura from Dark Horse. So the new editions are basically, this is from the very earliest days of manga publishing in English. So they are re-laid out. This whole thing was a very time consuming and expensive process. So when Tokyopop at a certain point said, hey, you know, this is 100% authentic manga. Here it is. Here's how it was in Japan. It was read less way. And he's made like, yeah, we're doing this so authentic, man. But it was inherently a cost saving measure.
Yeah, you could get the manga out a lot quicker and for a lot cheaper if you didn't have to meticulously flip and rework every single page in a 200-page volume. That's for sure.
Some artists, you know, didn't want that. Like I've heard like the creative Dragon Ball was like, no, don't flip my stuff. This yeah. is how it is.
So
interesting.
Yeah, mirroring your artwork is a way to find flaws in the drawing that you've made. Like if your perspective is wonky, or if you've like, you know, everyone has like a natural sort of lean to their work. So people will flip it and be like, oh, okay, this is okay. Or, oh man, I really screwed up the face here. Once you flip it, you can see it. Well, we were flipping everything. So it was exposing all of these errors in the artwork. And luckily you have people like Ryoichi Kagami, who drew My the Psychic Girl, who are just amazing illustrators, like so good. So there's just very few problems with their work, you know what I mean? But there are a lot of artists who just refuse to have their work flipped. And I think that's why we didn't get Dragon Ball until I think 10 years after Mexico and Latin America did. Dragon Ball was huge for almost a decade before we started to get it in comics and in anime. And it's, you know, comes down to cultural differences, but it also comes down to, we just didn't want to treat the material right. And the original Japanese author was like, I'm not going to let you do this to my work. And man, I wish we had more authors like that out there.
Yeah, for sure.
It interests me because, you know, a lot of the reading we do in America is left to right. And so we have to kind of switch gears when we do that. But, you know, if people are enjoying the story, and you can do it. I mean, I've done it, and it's an interesting thing to do. And, you know, if that's the way they want the story told, then, you know, that's kind of the way we should be doing it, in my estimation. But I'm just always fascinated because, you know, something that I thought was a huge impediment to having this the manga go out there doesn't seem to bother a lot of the readers at all.
No, everyone that's about a generation.
I don't want to discount the fact that it's uncomfortable, because it does take some getting used to.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. See, this whole thing is fascinating to me. Now, let's talk about the book itself. The first book is out. How many pages are in the first book?
A little over 200, I think. 220.
Something?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the first book. And of course, it came out on July 23rd. Any idea when the second book is going to be available?
Well, we serialized all of our manga online first on our Substack, which is mangasplaining.substack.com or mangasplainingextra.com. So you can, if you like the first volume, you can jump right into the second for just $5 a month. And we're going to start the third and final serialization soon too. But right now we're looking at volume two coming out. I think it'll be next winter. It's July now. Yeah, it'll be a spring 2025 release for volume five, which will probably be like a March, April situation, or volume two, sorry. So
that's not bad. That's about 6 months or so.
Yeah. We're trying for every 6 months, but it's tough because this book actually got bumped 3 months due to an issue with the printer and had to switch printing facilities and countries. So, you know, you never quite know what's going to happen when you're printing a book. It's physical media. There's a lot of hands on the wheel, let's say. So yeah, Fantagraphics has been absolutely awesome all the way through. They're the publisher, the print publisher here. And, but yeah, so we're hoping for volume two next year, next spring, and then volume three, probably 6 months after that. But we've actually been working on a bunch of other books. We've got another one coming out just after this one in September. And Deb, would you like to tell the fine listeners of Wayne's podcast all about Gigatown?
Yeah, it's completely different in tone and style and content. It's called Gigatown, A Guide to Manga Iconography. It is basically a series of four-panel gag comic strips that illustrate what these different visual symbols that are unique to manga are, like, you know, a little sweat drop, or like, you know, the little thing that looks like a little starburst that's basically supposed to symbolize you're irritated because your veins are throbbing. Mm-hmm. Or there's like, you know, things like, you know, like swirls above your head, meaning like you're dizzy or you're confused. Some of these are common to all comics, but some of these are uniquely Japanese. And this artist, Fumio Kono, basically takes these symbols and like she uses them in like in these really charming and funny little examples where it shows, she explains what the symbol means by on the side. And then in the comic, it shows it in use. So it's it's a very unique comic, I gotta say, and it's one I really fell in love with when I first saw it at the British Museum Manga Show back in 2019. And I thought to myself, man, this is so good. Why isn't anyone publishing this in English? Please, someone publish it in English.
And it's the first. We're publishing it in English, which is great. It's the first catalog and explanation for all of the symbols that are used in manga. And I think it's going to be really useful for the librarians that we were talking about. It's going to be really useful for, you know, people creators that want to make up their own stories. I think it's going to, but it's also, the comics are super charming. They're like a very gentle kind of newspaper strip humor. And I think that just reading them there, you'll get a couple chuckles out of it, I think, while you read it too. So yeah, we're trying to do something that really is manga splaining. You know what I mean? Like explain some manga to people and we'll use manga to do it.
Cause I was watching the Teen Titans Go cartoon, and they use a lot of those symbols in that show. And I, at first I was like, what is that? What's going on with that? You know, why is there suddenly a star on their forehead and stuff? And, you know, they had a lot of influence on that cartoon. And I've seen other ones do it too. Mm-hmm. So it's something that'd be very useful, I think, for people to understand, especially if we're not, brought up in the culture that uses them. So that sounds like a good idea. It sounds like a thing that we could use.
Thanks. We hope so too.
So are there other books you guys are, maybe you can't talk about them at this point yet, but there's other things in the works that we might be getting to see soon?
Yeah. The Deb's editing a couple of books actually, but the next one, I think the first one that'll be out, it's actually going to be a race, is Wandering Cat's Cage. Deb, you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, that one is, it's another science fiction story, but it's a very different tone of science fiction. Or speculative fiction, I guess. It's by it's called Wandering Cat's Cage, and it's by Akane Torikai. Manga readers might know her from her work called Sensei's Pious Lie, which is a very complex grown-up relationship drama, so to speak. Wandering Cat's Cage is the simplest way I can describe it. It's like a dystopian future where men are rare and reproduction is even rarer. Natural reproduction is even rarer. Hmm. So it basically takes place in a kind of a vaguely Asian city. One side of the river has a slum and the other side of the river has a very posh city. And on both sides of the river, it's a female-led societies. And so one day, one of the slum side of there's a young woman who is basically like, you know, kind of a leader, kind of someone who just kind of everyone respects. And there's also one guy who is basically very in demand because he can give pleasure to women. Hmm. But it's as you dig, and it starts out that way. But as Torikai Sensei lets the story unfold, you get to see what the rot is behind underneath that society, and why. And how things got that way. Hmm. It's a little bit like Handmaid's Tale, but without the Christian and guilt and oppressiveness.
Yeah.
And this time it's the women oppressing other women.
Mm. We wanted to do something. Akane Torikai is just an amazing, amazing creator who, again, was really underrepresented in North America, just like Kaneko Sensei with Search and Destroy. And in the time that we started talking to her about doing this work, you know, Sensei's Pious Lie was released, which is great. And it's going to be, we're kind of positioning it like a Japanese inversion sort of take on The Handmaid's Tale. And I think, again, that one was also serialized online. You can go read it now for some paying subscribers. And yeah, it's going to be a really interesting volume when it comes out. Maybe we'll come back on the podcast to talk a little bit more about that. It's a lot easier to follow. The panel layouts are really a lot more traditional. But we've got lots of stuff in the hopper that we want to work on. Deb's currently editing a biography of someone who worked in manga as a teenager in the 70s, unlike the most popular, most popular
girls comic
in the, of the age. It's a little bit like the... what's his name, that did Legion of Superheroes. He got the job when he was a teen.
Well, Paul Levitz? No.
No, Jim Shooter.
Jim Shooter. Sort of like that, where all of a sudden she's coming home after school and then going and working as an assistant on mangaka kind of stuff. We're also doing a full color manga called Veil, which will be out TBD. But the first four volumes are done, and we're just sort of looking at a release schedule for that with our partners at Udon Entertainment. So, yeah, we got lots in the hopper. We've got stuff that's licensed that we haven't announced yet or can't announce, unfortunately. But yeah, mangasplainingextra.com. Don't worry, we're going to just keep releasing great manga that people are not expecting. And which is probably going to disappoint people too, because once you like Atsushi Kaneko, you're like, do everything he's got. And I'd love to, but, you know, licensing being what it is, sometimes it's more difficult than others.
Well, this is the time to do it, in my estimation. I mean, manga right now is on the rise.
Problem is so is everybody else. I'm working on my panel slides for San Diego Comic Con, and every year I run a panel about the manga it's like a manga publishing roundtable. So like the people, the executives, the head editors at the different U.S. English manga publishing companies get together, and they kind of talk about what's hot, what's not, what's on the rise, what's getting tired, and what they're worried about, what they're excited about. And generally speaking, you know, one of the slides says, there are so many people jumping into the manga pool. I had to update my slide from last year, and I added like six or eight more companies. And there are a couple more that I couldn't add because they're not announced yet. So it's kind of nuts.
Well, you know, we're always hungry for new and different stories. And so, you know, manga might be the way that we're going to get some of those things. You know, I have to say, as a Batman fan, they almost married Batman off to Catwoman. And I was disappointed when they didn't, because I've been reading Batman for decades, and I've seen a lot of Batman stories, and him being married was something I haven't read before. And so I was actually looking forward to that. And, you know, I was disappointed when they just kind of turned away from each other and jumped off into the night in different directions. And I was like, what? Why'd they do that?
Kind of moonlighting, don't you think? I mean, there was a certain point where Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd were just not as interesting anymore when they didn't like flirting.
See, we need new stuff. And I think that, well, I have to tell you, I read that one Operation Joker, and it was a fascinating story. The whole idea is the Joker's decided to turn Batman to be like him. And he drops him into a vat of chemicals, because that's how he became the Joker. But instead of making him into the Joker, it turns Bruce Wayne into a baby.
Yeah. Isn't that ingenious?
I thought we'd never see that in American comics.
That's what I love about these the Japanese, the manga artists taking on these characters, is that they take a really fresh and bizarre approach to it. You know, like, the Superman versus Meshi is basically about Superman coming to Japan and trying all the food, as you do in Japan, because the food's really good.
And I think DC's doing that one in English, aren't they?
Yeah, they're publishing it, yeah.
Yeah, all three volumes of that One Operation Joker are out now in English. Mm-hmm. But they did, like you guys, they translate it, but you still have to go right to left.
I think if you're going to read manga, you kind of got to get used to that, except in very, very rare cases.
But that one surprised me. I do have to say, it ends interestingly. I like the way it ended. This is the problem. And I've been reading, I'm talking about people about Star Trek about this too, is that so often we don't challenge the reader or do something different because we're afraid that they'll get offended and turn away.
That's kind of like, well, that's what's really amazing about this, right? Is that the manga artists were given this playground, right? Or these characters or this world. And then they weren't tied down by the orthodoxy past expectations of what it should or shouldn't be. So they just had fun with it. And like if you look at a Webtoon, for example, right, there's Batman Family Adventures.
Yep.
That's inherently it's a Batman story for Webtoon readers, because it's kind of just heartwarming and mostly focus on the kids in the family, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like what happens when they're not out on adventures, what happens, and we get to see their family life and stuff.
It's like really that. Charming. I mean, I find it kind of comforting and fun to read.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy it. I have all the volumes. I have the books. So it's good stuff. So there's all kinds of good things out there. And so you guys, you said your website. Say it again for us in case people want to keep up with you guys.
You can find us online at mangasplaining.com, and that's sort of the front page for everything that we do, including the podcast and the publishing. Or if you want to jump right to our newsletter and publishing endeavor, go to mangasplainingextra.com. But it's hard to understand that sometimes when we're saying it on on the internet or on a podcast. So just search Deb AOKI on Twitter, and she will link back to everything that we're doing. She's very easy to find on there.
But not you, Christopher.
No, I'm a mystery.
Okay. Some people avoid the internet.
The social media thing, whereas I just dive in. I like it.
It has a lot of challenges to it. The one thing I don't do is get into arguments with people on the internet. If somebody says something, I say, I like that, or I don't like that, but I'm not going to sit here and fight about those kinds of things. So,
Oh, it's not worth it at all. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Anyway, it's called Search and Destroy, and the first volume is already available. Is it in general bookstores? You know, is it in local comic shops as well, or is it just
everywhere? It's a beautiful real book. It's got French flaps. The production Fantagraphics did an amazing job on it. Book looks great. But yeah, you can find it on Amazon. You can find it in hopefully your local book and comic book stores. You can find it on the Fantagraphics website, the publisher, and they will ship directly to your door anywhere in the world.
All right. Well, both of you, I wish you much success with this. And I bet we'll be seeing a lot more of your good materials out there. And I'll have to start listening to the podcast. My problem is I make a podcast, so I'm busy making it. I don't have time to go and listen to other podcasts all that much. But it sounds really interesting to me. And I would like to know more about manga and anime and those kinds of things and stuff. So the two of you, I wish you much success and keep it up. I think that's wonderful stuff.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Wayne. It's been great to be here.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support this show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
So I leave, knowing that a world full of heroes has nothing to fear.